During the first half of the 1970s, the Oakland A's were the most colorful team in baseball, with bright double-knit uniforms, long hair, and outlandish personalities. They were also the best team, winning 5 straight division titles and 3 straight World Series from 1972 through 1974. Author Jason Turbo gives us some great background on a forgotten dynasty with his new book, Dynastic Bombastic Fantastic, Reggie, Raleigh, Catfish, and Charlie Finley's Swingin' A's. Jason, the story of this team during this era begins and ends with the owner, Charles O. Finley, who brought the franchise to Oakland from Kansas City in 1968. He was nothing if not interesting, very innovative, some might say zany, very controlling, and an egomaniac. Those last two descriptions really ruined him at the end as his reputation amongst his players soured. But how was his reputation amongst the fans in Oakland?
Boy, you nailed that description of him. His reputation was not great with the fans in either of the cities in which he played. He owned the team in Kansas City before he moved it to Oakland. At first he tried to be accessible. He tried to make the ballpark experience a good one. He repainted the ballpark in Kansas City. He put a petting zoo in right field. Like, who knows why, but he did it for the fan experience. He did lots of things. He never really drummed up enthusiasm for his team. He had a terrible product on the field, and he pissed off the city fathers to no end. So the entire community turned on him. And then he moved to Oakland, except that he didn't. He moved the team to Oakland. He stayed in Chicago, which was the base for his insurance business. He never made any effort to integrate himself or his team into the fabric of Oakland society. And people here really, if they thought at all about him, it was with that in mind. Like, he was never one of them, and he never tried to be one of them. And an easy comparison is to look at the team that shared the A's home ballpark, the Oakland Coliseum. Al Davis owned the Raiders, and he was all about the East Bay. He had the people here buying whatever it is he had to sell. He sold out every ticket. He had the most devoted fan base in all the NFL because he cared about the people and the people cared about him.
Some of Finley's innovations included having a mule as a mascot, experimenting with the bright orange baseball. He was instrumental in bringing the designated hitter to the American League, and he encouraged his players to grow out their hair, both on their heads and on their faces. Those are just a few of his ideas. He was also, for quite a time, a small period of time, quite generous with his players when it came to providing gifts and rewards, even though he was very stiff with rewarding contracts.
Yeah, he would never bend on salaries. He was, always miserly when it came to giving guys their just rewards on contracts. But yeah, early on, he could be incredibly generous. I mean, he rewarded the 72 championship team, his first World Series winner, by giving every player on the roster a full-size replica trophy. He gave them lavish World Series rings. The Major League Baseball allotted, I think it was $300 for owners to spend on championship rings. He got them rings that, believably appraised at well above $2,000. At the same time, He wouldn't bend an inch when it came to paying them the salaries they thought they deserved. The most notable example of that was in 1972 when Vida Blue held out. Vida in 1971 had been not only the best pitcher in the American League, but the best player. He won Cy Young and MVP awards. He was only 21 years old. He was the biggest drawing card in baseball. A stat that still blows my mind. One out of every 12 American League tickets sold in 1971 was to see Vida Blue pitch. He was selling out ballparks across the land. Finley made him a genuinely fair contract offer. He offered him $50,000, which was a huge raise, and it would have been the highest salary ever paid to a second-year player. But Vida knew what he was worth to the team, and he knew what he was worth to the league, and he wanted more, and he held out. But once Finley set his mind on being correct, once he felt he had the moral high ground, damned if he could be budged from that spot. He didn't cede an inch, and he was content to let Vida sit out the season. After 6 weeks of Vida not playing, Commissioner Bowie Kuhn eventually ordered Simley to make a fair offer, and he ordered Vida to accept it. And that's how Vida Blue came back to the A's. But he was never the same player after that. He was still very, very good, but boy, he was on an early Hall of Fame track that never quite materialized.
The roster of talent on those A's teams is remarkably deep. Reggie Jackson in the outfield, Bert Campaneris batting leadoff, Raleigh Fingers in the bullpen, as you said, Vida Blue is one of the top starting pitchers. And another great starting pitcher was a North Carolina native named Jim Hunter, who became known as Catfish upon joining the A's. And that nickname was given to him specifically by Finley because it would be good for his business. It would be a good box office draw. Talk about the background to that story, how Jim Hunter became Catfish Hunter.
Sure. Well, Finley was, you know, ever the showman. You know, he really admired Bill Veeck, who was the showman owner in baseball before him, and did lots of things to try and goose business from a showmanship angle. And one of those things was having a colorful roster. He wanted to give everybody nicknames because he thought they would be, you know, more become more ingrained into local households if they were colorful that way. He signed Jim Hunter out of Hertford, North Carolina. Hunter was a schoolboy phenomenon. Once Finley locked him up, though, he said, "There's one more thing I need to know." Jim Hunter said, "What's that?" Charlie Finley asked, "Do you have a nickname?" Jim Hunter said, "I do not have a nickname." Finley said, "Okay, here's your story. When you were a kid, you ran away from home. Your parents frantically went searching for you. They found you down by the creek where you were holding a long string of catfish that you caught that afternoon. Ever since, your nickname has been Catfish." And Jim Hunter was a teenager when he heard this story. He thought it would be forgotten about by morning. He said, "Okay, whatever you say, sir." Little did he know that baseball history would not remember Jim Hunter at all. The only guy who would exist in the annals is a guy named Catfish.
And Reggie Jackson was the 1973 World Series MVP. And his reputation as let's be honest, a self-absorbed player was far more exasperated with the New York Yankees, who he would join in 1977, than it was in Oakland, primarily because in New York he dealt with the equally egotistical Billy Martin and George Steinbrenner, and as I read you put, because many of the players in Oakland were with Reggie in the minor leagues, became accustomed to who he was, so therefore it wasn't much of a problem.
Yeah, I mean, Reggie may have changed somewhat upon reaching a bigger media market like New York, but at his core, he was the same guy. Like the difference being that most of these A's players had known him for many years, and some of them were teenagers, and they knew that for all his bark, he did not have much bite. He was egotistical. He wanted the spotlight. He wanted the media attention, but he wasn't out really to hurt anybody, and so his teammates were able to compartmentalize that pretty easily. When he got to New York, nobody really knew him like that, and it was easy to take the loudest guy in the room the wrong way.
Reggie Jackson starts it off in the second inning for the A's. They can't come up there. There's a long, long drive to deep left, going and gone. Jackson is homered to the opposite field. The kind of power that he has, he hits some of the longest shots in baseball. And that's the kind of power that he had in last year's World Series.
Yeah, I mean, he was not without his conflicts, though. I mean, he had a season-long feud with Bill North, but this was one of many in-house feuds. In doing your research, did you find there to be a primary instigator of these disputes?
No, that's the thing about this team. There wasn't one guy. Reggie was the loudest one in the room with the biggest ego, and he desperately wanted to be a team leader, and in many ways he was. He was easily the best player on the team. But there were, you know, 9 or 10 guys in that clubhouse who felt like they were the leader of the team. And what that meant was that any time someone messed up on the field or exhibited bad behavior or showed bad judgment, they would hear about it. And they would hear about it from multiple avenues until that behavior was fixed. This team was built on a process of needling each other, almost to the point of distraction. But it also kept everyone really on edge when it came to peak performance. They knew that if they slipped at all, they'd be hearing about it from a lot of their teammates. At the same time, those boundaries were pushed so persistently that occasionally they were crossed, and that's what led to a lot of the fistfights. It goes hand in hand, their excellence and their inability to tolerate each other. You know, one thing they had going for them, no matter how much they hated each other, they always knew that everybody in the room hated the owner more.
Yeah, and that led to the biggest feud of all, and we'll get to that in a minute. But the Reggie and Bill North feud, I can't remember. What was the origin to that?
The origin to that was a woman. The details have been a little bit lost to history. I asked Billy North about it four or five different occasions. I put it any number of ways. He'd give me the details of the fight, but he would not give me the details of where it originated. Reggie claimed it was about a woman, and Bill said whatever Reggie said is fine. So that's all I had to go with. What ultimately happened was Reggie was in the clubhouse, coming out of the trainer's room wearing nothing but a towel. Billy North stormed in, nostrils flaring, pissed off, walked right over to Reggie, and within moments, they were just brawling. It was unusual among A's fights in that usually the impetus happened inside the clubhouse. This one happened somewhere else, and Billy just took it right to Reggie, and he became the latest in a kind of a string of people to beat up Reggie in the clubhouse. It ended badly for several people. Reggie was one of them. Aside from getting beat up, he clipped his shoulder on a locker on the way to the ground as he was falling, injured himself slightly. He had been going gangbusters before that. He'd been hitting nearly 400. He went into a severe tailspin, partly because he was injured and partly because he was a really emotional guy. It's hard to picture, but he was sensitive. And when people criticized him overtly, he could take it unbelievably personally, and it was known to affect his performance on the field. He went into a crazy tailspin, and it wasn't until Bill North realized this. I mean, they weren't talking to each other for a while. It wasn't until North realized, hey, you know, we're not going to win if Reggie's not at his best, that he extended an olive branch, the two made up, and, you know, Reggie got back to being his usual self on the field. The other casualty from that fight was catcher Ray Fossey, who, in racing in to break it up, ended up, you know, falling backwards and hitting his own head on a locker. He did some nerve damage in his neck and was essentially lost for the season. And I think one of the very excellent details of this fight was that there was a bridge game in the middle of the room. Four guys playing bridge. A cadre of players were obsessed with the game. They didn't so much as look up from their hands. These guys started brawling right next to him. They're like, all right, someone's going to break it up. I got a hand I want to play. And they just kept right on playing.
They had bigger priorities at the time. I guess
Exactly. Also
I guess they were used to it, so they just let it go.
Yeah, it was old news. They'd seen it before.
Mm-hmm. And now the fight or the feud that really it's where really things turned against Charlie Finley, and one of the main events that you detail in the book occurred during the 1973 World Series against the Mets. And personally, as a Mets fan, I'm not old enough to have watched what happened. But I certainly know about this incident on the periphery, and then you can fill in the details. But it involves Mike Andrews, a little-known infielder at the time, who had signed on with the A's in late July of that year. He makes two errors in the 12th inning of a Game 2 defeat in Oakland. He had a ball roll through his legs, and then he made an errant throw to first that pulled Gene Tennis off the first base bag. Then what happened afterwards is truly bizarre and unfortunate. Describe what took place after that game two and the length to which Finley intervened with Andrews' status for the remainder of the series.
Yeah, it was incredible. And before I tell you what happened after that, there's just a little bit of preamble, which is that Andrews, you know, longtime second baseman, he was once an excellent second baseman. He had hurt his shoulder sometime before. It had healed enough for him to play baseball, but not to be an effective defender. He was no longer a good defender. The A's knew this when they signed him. They signed him exclusively to be a right-handed pinch hitter. Andrews had played for Dick Williams back in Boston, and he was one of his favorite players. So they knew he wasn't going to play the field. How he ended up at second base in the extra innings during the World Series is its own story, but he wasn't happy to be there, and it cost the team. Charlie Finley sufficiently nuanced to understand what had happened. All he saw was a guy making errors in the field. He thought, I want to replace him with minor league second baseman Manny Trio. The only way he could do that was as an injury replacement. Your rosters are locked down in the World Series. Mm-hmm. So he had his team doctor give Andrews a cursory examination. He had him draft up a memo indicating, in my opinion, he is too injured to continue playing in this World Series, even though Andrews was no more injured than he was the day they signed him. And he strong-armed Andrews into signing it. The A's players, while all this was happening, were out on the bus, which, for reasons none of them could understand, was not moving toward the airport like it was supposed to. It was waiting for Dick Williams, who had to witness all of this, and it was waiting for, ostensibly, Mike Andrews to show up. Once Andrews signed that thing, he could not bear to go back on that bus. He just kind of slunk out of the ballpark in the other direction. The players on the bus quickly realized what was happening. Andrews wasn't there. A few of them had seen the examination going on. They worked themselves up into a chant, "We want Mike, we want Mike," and then the bus took off without him. And they flew to New York in a rage. These guys knew that if Finley could fire someone for making errors, he could fire any of them for making errors. And that's part of baseball, is making errors. And when they landed in the country's biggest media market, in the middle of the sport's biggest stage, and reporters could not get enough comments out of them. They talked themselves hoarse about what a rotten situation it was and what a rotten guy Charlie Finley was for doing it. The next day was workout day at Shea Stadium. They wore Andrews number 17 taped to their sleeves in athletic tape. They were showing up the owner in every way possible, and Finley never forgave them for it. He turned sour. He withdrew every nice thing he had ever done for them. He stopped his series of bonuses he'd given them. He pulled every possible perk out of the clubhouse. Then before long, they had to pay for their own postage on outgoing mail, meaning they had to, if they wanted to respond to fan mail, they had to pay for it themselves. Right? It was down to that granular level. Eventually, Bowie Kuhn ordered Finley to reinstate Andrews, which he did. And Dick Williams, God bless him, despite Finley having told him, "I want that guy nowhere near the field," sent Mike Andrews up to pinch hit at his earliest available opportunity. And the Mets fans, this speaks very well of Mets fans, knew exactly what was going on. They gave Andrews a standing ovation because they knew it was a stand against Finley. And Andrews grabbed it out, and they gave him another ovation on the way back to the dugout. Dick Williams was so fed up with the entire situation that after the A's won, after Game 7, in the victorious clubhouse, as champagne was flying, he quit on the spot.
That's pretty interesting to just, like, when you're celebrating and all, and your mind is on the victory, and the first thing you're thinking of is, "I want to get out of here."
Yeah, for sure. He had kind of made up his mind before they had won. He made up his mind during while the Andrews thing was at its peak, and he maybe made a mistake by informing his team. He called them in a meeting, the meeting that was ostensibly called to give Finley's side of the Andrews situation, and he said, "Oh yeah, one more thing. I'm going to deny it if it leaks out of here, but I'm quitting after this World Series, win, lose, or draw." That gave his team a little bit to think about. They're trying to focus on the Mets. Suddenly they have to deal with mutiny directed at the ownership, and now they have to deal with their manager quitting, like, a couple games down the road. Like, the fact that they were able to put that aside was remarkable.
Yeah, and they had to come back from 3-2, had to win the last two in Oakland, and of course they did that. And another thing about that game four was Finley was in the stands, in the crowd, when that all happened.
Yeah, he had been pretty much the only guy not giving Mike Andrews a standing ovation was the owner of Mike Andrews' own team.
I guess maybe there are reasons to this that I don't know. Or why didn't Mike Andrews maybe stand up to Finley and go, "I'm not doing this," and kind of, bolt because he, to save face?
He did at first, but I mean, he was worried. He was at the tail end of his career. In the heat of the moment, he was worried that it would reflect badly on him if he tried to catch on with another team. He thought maybe if, word got out that he was injured, he could actually use it to his advantage and saying, "My arm is healable and I'll be able to perform again." Like, it was very confusing. Like, no knock on Andrews in this situation, but there were a lot of factors at play, particularly his livelihood in the future. And he ended up regretting that. He said afterward, his only regret from the whole situation wasn't the errors. It was signing that piece of paper that said he was too injured to play.
And it was interesting also that the players were so supportive of him. I mean, I guess the way you were talking about it was more of a revolt against Finley. But the fact that they, you know, wore 17, I mean, this was a guy that had only been there for a couple months, and they're all backing him to the hilt.
Yeah, I mean, he was one of them. He was their kind of guy. He was a tough, a scrappy player. You know, in his heyday, he was one of the American League's better second basemen. Not many of them knew him very well, but they knew injustice when they saw it, and they knew whose side they were on, if evidenced only by the fact they all wore the same uniform.
So after winning that second straight World Series in 1973 and previously having beaten Cincinnati in 72, they then beat the Los Angeles Dodgers in the 1974 World Series. Catfish Hunter then departs. In 75, they win the AL West but get swept by the Red Sox in the League Championship Series. And things really plummet after that. Reggie Jackson departs for a brief stay in Baltimore before then going to New York. And other key pieces leave. And before long, Oakland is a last-place club. The team's demise coincided with not only advent of free agency, but also Finley's dismissive attitude toward it.
Well, yeah, it was. I mean, that was the entire reason that the team broke up. He had a great young team locked up. I mean, all the key components were not even 30 years old. Most of them were 28 or 27 or younger. But free agency was coming. Finley was, you know, the loudest voice in the room telling them, fellow owners, you do not allow this to happen. And he couldn't adapt. He wouldn't adapt. He was an autocrat. He was a guy who had to have his way when it came to everything. And it was the only way he could run his organization. It worked really well in his insurance industry. He was visionary there. He ran things well. In baseball, it didn't work out so well, and when arbitration and then free agency came around, giving the players a say in their own future, Finley was unwilling to abide it. All those key guys, they're known as the Oakland Seven that last year, the seven guys who were going to play out their contracts and become free agents, they almost to a man put multi-year offers on Finley's desk at the beginning of that season, which were well below market value, and Finley didn't even bother to respond to them. By the end of the year, he realized what a bargain they'd been offering him, and he tried to reanimate the offers, and by that point, they were finished with him. And everyone bolted, and Finley was left with, you know, ashes of his roster. It's worth noting that across the country, a guy who knew very well how to play the new game, George Steinbrenner, ended up winning back-to-back championships with Finley's two best players, Reggie Jackson and Catfish Hunter.
So in reading your bio, I see you're from California. Did you have a particular personal inspiration for taking on this project?
I didn't. I actually grew up a Giants fan across the bay. The A's were always fine in my book. I held the 1989 World Series against them pretty severely. But no, the inspiration for this book actually came when I was walking down Main Street in Cooperstown a number of years back, researching a different project. And I realized, holy cow, you know, I'm surrounded by Yankees and Mets and Dodgers and Red Sox and Cubs stuff. And I've got to dig really hard in Cooperstown, New York to realize this A's team even existed. Mm-hmm. This is the only team ever, other than the Yankees, ever to win three straight World Series. This is an all-time great team with some amazing stories behind it. Like this, I think these stories would be just as vibrant. This book would be just almost as good if it had been a last-place team. Like, the day-to-day drama was ridiculous. And the fact that people seem to have forgotten about it was really my inspiration.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question. As I said in the open, they were a forgotten dynasty. I'm trying to think of reasons for that. I mean, they won three straight World Series, five straight AL West titles. Even in the pre-free agency era, that's pretty good. But they probably get overshadowed by the Reds, of that time, who were just coming along, the Big Red Machine, of course, even though they only won two championships. Why do you think they get forgotten about? I mean, is it the media market? Is it something else?
It's yes and yes. It is and it is. Oakland is a small market. These guys, even as they were winning World Series, were complaining. Like, they couldn't get endorsement deals. They would say, you know, if we played in Boston or New York or Chicago or L.A., we would be turning away stuff. Instead, we can't show down in L.A., just down the coast. Like, they couldn't get any endorsement offers. The only guy to make money off these World Series runs, really, was Joe Rudy. And the reason he made money is that he ran an insurance business in the offseason and placed an ad in the World Series program. And that drummed up business for him. But that's part of it. I think a bigger part is that Finley alienated everybody. On one hand, he alienated his fellow owners. You know, he was a guy used to getting his way. He was a guy used to coming up with many, many, many ideas. He was visionary in many ways. You know, some of his ideas were great, and some of his ideas were terrible. But he tried to ramrod those things into effect. Damn the opposition. He made enemies throughout baseball among the ownership ranks. So they weren't particularly eager to promote the A's. And then in Finley's own stadium, he couldn't sell it out. And if you can't sell out your own stadium, you know, how is anyone else going to pay attention to you?
You spoke to a number of former players, coaches, broadcasters, front office personnel. Unfortunately, Finley, Dick Williams, and Catfish Hunter have since passed away. If you could talk about your efforts to try and get those subjects, knowing how important they were to describing some of the behind-the-scenes stories that you detail in the book.
Yeah, well, getting the players was actually the easy part. My timing on this was excellent because the A's kept staging 40-year reunions of each of these teams, and all the guys would show up at the ballpark once a year. So it was easy to just kind of work the room and tell them I was working on a book and get their contact information to hook up with them later. And that part was simple. I mean, traveling the country to talk with these guys was a joy. You know, my white whales were the front office personnel who are not public figures. And, you know, who might not have the most common names, who are difficult to track down. But I managed to get a lot of them who told some great stories. You know, people who worked behind the scenes with Charlie Finley, you know, by and large, felt similarly to those who worked in front of the scenes with Charlie Finley. And, you know, even the guy, like their traveling secretary, a guy named Jimmy Bank, didn't really express animosity toward Finley, but he quit the job anyway. He quit because he was a full-time traveling secretary. And Finley also made him a full-time PR guy. And then Finley also made him a full-time statistician, which meant he was essentially at the ballpark for all but about 6 hours of every day, and he just couldn't take it anymore. So he's digging his employees a hole one way or another.
Yeah, talk about burnout. That's three full-time jobs.
Finley was, you know, his personal motto was sweat plus sacrifice equals success. And he was a guy who wore, you know, more hats than anybody. He didn't mind working 20 hours a day and never sleeping. So he expected everyone else under him to do the same.
To listen to more episodes, including interviews with Mario Andretti, Ken Burns, and Jack Ham, among others, subscribe to the Profiles in Sports podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, Google Play, and elsewhere. Also, please check out our website, profilesinsports.com, as well as our Facebook page. And lastly, you can follow me on Twitter, @BrianWright86.